Hey everybody, this is Alan Abadesa Green from Syncbook Press and allthehappycreatures.blogspot.com. Earlier today I spoke with Bill Klaus from ayahuasca.blogspot.com and David Plate, also known as MK Ultrasound, from beingthere723.blogspot.com. You know, as I've been doing this whole Syncbook thing, I've encountered a lot of really interesting and underrated people working within the Sync community, and these are definitely two incredibly bright minds and two very skilled writers, thinkers, and I'm very, very happy to have spoken to them today. I've actually gotten to know them fairly well over the last few months, just really impressed with them. And so when Bill Klaus asked me about trying to put together some sort of show, just to be able to sit down and have a conversation with other thinkers and challenge some thoughts and learn some new things and develop ideas together. And when he asked me about it, I just thought it was such a wonderful idea and I jumped on the opportunity. I think if you enjoy synchronicity, you know, Stanley Kubrick, Pink Floyd, really weird shit, esotericism, you name it. It's just really good conversation. It's just really, really good conversation. It was absolute pleasure, and I swear if it's half as enjoyable to listen to as it was to partake in, then you're really gonna enjoy this. In the future, we'll probably have other authors come on, other writers, bloggers, artists, whomever. The idea is just to open a conversation, a sort of round table, on a regular basis to have people, you know, keep talking. Ultimately, that's the point, is just to keep talking and see where these ideas develop. Without further ado, enjoy.
For millions of years, mankind lived just like the animals. Something happened, which unleashed the power of our imagination. We learned to talk.
We're all obsessed with Kubrick.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
I mean, George Lucas pretty much, you know, I hate him so much. And he brought something to my childhood, you know, that was really important, and Kubrick never let me down and never will. So that's, you know, it's different. When I was a kid, I remember asking my mom about 2001. She's like, you wouldn't like that. It's too slow. You know, it's my favorite movie, you know.
Well, it's kind of bizarre for me because, you know, cable hit America in like 79, 1980, I think, with HBO, maybe 78. And I don't even know how much it was, but my grandparents weren't necessarily wealthy, but they got cable, I think mostly for the boxing, so my uncles could watch the fights. But I remember being 5 years old and seeing 2001 on cable and just being mesmerized and thinking that, you know, this was real. And it burned into my brain in a way that no other movie ever did. And I feel so lucky to have had that experience. And I don't know how young you guys were when you first saw 2001. But, you know, it more so just as much as I think it almost made me realize that Star Wars was fake. 2001 was real. And I think I processed that, or I want to make myself believe I processed that at 5 years old. But there was just a quality to it that it wasn't announcing itself as entertainment. It was trying to tell me it was real at some level. Mm-hmm. And then to watch the space movies progress from 1981 onwards, mm-hmm. and nothing looked as good as 2001, that was always such a bizarre dynamic for me as a kid, because it was everything else improved, but the space movies decayed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I agree with that.
And
I will say, you know, the whole George Lucas, I definitely prefer
Kubrick to Lucas, but I do give him credit for, like, if you look at the first Star Wars movie, or, you know, part four, whatever, a lot of those space shots with the models and the backdrops do look pretty good. They're not Kubrick good, but they're pretty darn good.
Fucking good. I like, you know, THX 1138.
Yeah.
That with 2001, like, that is, like, those are so complimentary as far as I'm concerned. They put me in the same state. I think I saw them around the same time when I was, like, 16, and that was, like, both of those I would actually consider pretty much equally, like, had an impact on me. I love THX 1138. I can watch that over. And I feel the same way about it in terms of cutting it up. I've experimented with that movie. I've sampled half the movie in mixes. I've done shows where I'll just take THX 1138. I've set it up with a VHS and a television set in front of my turntables and just let it play and run the sound into my 303 sampler and just threw effects on everything and then accompanied it with music. You know, I've done that multiple times. It's like my favorite way to fucking mix. And I haven't done that with 2001, but I would think that I could. It was just the soundtrack of 2001 with the classical could get tricky. It might sound annoying, actually. But THX 1138, just strict ambient soundtrack. It's perfect for, you know, the that kind of cut-up experiment.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, what I think makes a difference here is just that, like, THX, you could tell it was going for more an ambience, an abstract, you know, you could see, like, a remnant of avant-garde aesthetic in there, which you're not going to get in a mainstream film, that kind of, like, film overlays and stuff like that. But what I also think is the concern is as the technology, quote-unquote, improved, people relied more on digital stuff. I mean, you remember how bad everything was in the 80s with these, like, you know, everything looked like Dire Straits video, you know, that, like, really cheesy CGI, you know, big blocky stuff. You know, look at, like, Forbidden Planet, that monster from the id. Looks pretty good. Pretty damn good. And then, like, somehow, 30 years later, everything looks, like, 10 times worse. And then it's like, oh, because now we got the computers that'll do it for us, and we can... And even to this day, you know, I remember that Star Wars 2, I think it is, and there's just, like, this shot, which for some reason they use in all the trailers of these... Maybe it was the first one or the second one, I don't know. These, like, warships coming down this green hill. And it just looked like Microsoft Paint. It looked like this green hill and just this thing kind of being, you know, flash animation over it. And it's like, that looks like someone made that on the internet. That looks like some joke cartoon. So, for me, I'm not a big space opera buff. I like it, but I have a more of a sort of sympathy with the creature works, meaning I look at Jim Henson's puppetry and those things look so full of life. And then you see any movie now where they might take an animal and animate a mouth over it, or they might completely CGI the animal or whatever they do, but these animals feel so lifeless to me, whereas those puppets, just the older technology, again, like, that's why I say, like, the models, when they use model spaceships on a backdrop, for me, seeing a puppet being moved is so much more lifelike. And this is where I find the distinction.
Well, isn't it that human touch that is able to be integrated into the effect? Like, all the model building that took place in Star Wars, the human touch is all over that shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, programming something in a computer in 1988 is just devoid of that. I mean, there's a thread of it, but it's not. It doesn't even compare. So, like you said, too, Henson with his puppetry and with the different things they had. I mean, obviously, human element is all in that, and it's animating it in a way that we take as real. I don't think, I'll say this, the CGI aliens and John Carter are pretty amazing as far as acting goes. The Defoe alien, and granted, I haven't seen the movie yet without listening to Pink Floyd, but so I don't know how his voice is, but there are scenes, I mean, the reason why the actors in that movie are so cheesy and so fake is to illuminate just how real, quote unquote, the CGI actors are. And I can't even imagine what a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old would think when viewing those movies to see the CGI actors compared to the human actors.
Well, that was our last discussion talking about Freud's The Uncanny and how basically, you know, while watching Toy Story, I noticed there's just tons and tons of... you guys still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Tons and tons of references to The Shining. And I'm like, what is the fucking deal with Toy Story and The Shining? Like the carpet pattern and 237 all over the place or whatever and... and then, you know, I come across a quote from Stanley Kubrick saying that his big, one of his big inspirations for The Shining was, Freud's The Uncanny for how he did it. And so I went and I found Freud's The Uncanny and I read it. The book is much larger. The final section is The Uncanny. So they call the whole book The Uncanny, but really it's number of essays all grouped, which is what they commonly do with that kind of thing. But anyways, half the thing, or at least a good portion of it, is talking about the idea of insemination, like seeing life in something that is, we would consider lifeless. And the feeling that is aroused in that in people, if they consider that it's real, is one of not just terror, but he's saying a specific kind of response which is considered uncanny. So like there's an element of terror, it's a fear involved, but going into the psychology of why that fear arises. And like me in my room right now, I'm just like surrounded by toys. I have so many fucking toys. I have Star Wars toys all over the floor and fucking all kinds of stuff everywhere. And there's definitely something that I continually tripped out on is like when we form shapes and how with our imagination we can imbue them with life to a degree. And then just that on top of the whole putting a god before the source, you know, like you, as soon as you inseminate something with life, that's what they would call like, you know, idolatry or whatever. But we do this automatically, and there's almost no way around it. In fact, our whole psychostructure is built off of it because of the coping mechanism to try and localize ourself and build a holographic model of ourself in order to know, in order to kind of give the ego some autonomy, you know, which is, you know, like, I don't know, it's why we experience expansion when someone compliments us and why we contract if someone insults us. It's like everything's dependent upon this this thing that we make, that we project of ourselves. And so I was considering, like, if people look at a wall, there's like stucco patterns or whatever, how, or whatever, look at clouds, like what is this fucking like compulsion to see faces in it? You know, you see faces, like just about everybody does it, you know, and where does that come from and what is that about, you know? And so I think that there's something to be said about film and the way that we're looking to generate these models and these things and how, what satisfaction we get when it, the more real it looks, you know, and where that comes from, you know, other than just to prove that we can, it seems that there is some compulsive element at play in it, and there's a reason why, beyond the obvious, that it's so satisfying, you know.
Do you, you know, I could sort of take that in one of two ways. Like, in one respect, the toys are like a homunculus or a golem, even this idea of this thing that we've created, and then we can choose to look at it with an with animated eyes, and that's something I'd kind of like to talk to you guys about, because I see HAL in 2001 as very much the same thing. So we could take it in the Kubrick direction, but I wonder if the idea of seeing this thing with terror, these uncanny imbued life forces, isn't, you know, if we're Westerners having this conversation, for an Easterner, you know, the idea that everything has a life force in it, a rock, a tree, you know, that these are all imbued with spirit. And I wonder if that would be a less strange idea, and it's only for us that we kind of get freaked out. The same way someone, you know, in the West, we tell ghost stories as a scary thing. You know, in any paranormal experience or UFO experience, whatever it is that someone's encountering something out of the ordinary, people are usually freaked out by it. But I wonder if we were in a culture that sort of more recognized that there were other energies, even if it's a part of ourselves.
Right.
Well, the thing about toys, I just want to throw in real quick, I mean, Kubrick's last unofficial film is exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
The whole image of David when he comes home, the mother is freaked out.
Yeah.
She can't even look at it. And then over the next week or month or whatever it is, she grows to love it. She somehow, the robot doesn't change. It just pulls out of her love and her emotion, and it becomes, the flesh that covers it becomes sort of inseminated by her emotion. And to the point where she had, at the end of their relationship, instead of sending the hunk of metal and gears and wires to be destroyed, she sets it free somehow. She can't see it, quote unquote, die, even though there's nothing there to die. But really, it's just her own emotions that are, she can't see go away. So it's that whole thing, right, is all that, what that movie is all about.
I like that. You know, I had done something for The Mask of God, which was, you know, I think in AI, it's very much a homunculus. You know, it is the little man. But for something that I had thought about with HAL is the idea of a golem, this idea that you would take this figure, this clay figure, and then you inscribe a name on it, and then it'll do anything you want it to do. And then it was this idea that if you change the letters on its forehead, it would become uncontrollable, and then you had to rectify what was written. And not to give the punchline away, but to first explore, when you see HAL, he has all those circuit boards with those sort of numbers and letters on them, and you see that very much as that, where, like, he's out of control, and Dave Bowman, and then later Dr. Chandra, has to sort of correct what's written there. Now, the golem story, what has to be written there is the word truth. And you see in 2010, when Dr. Chandra arrives, HAL misfunctioned because he was lied to. He was told to lie. So it was only at the moment that the word truth, or the truth, was altered, that he became uncontrollable and was killing his masters. And what Chandra has to do, he said, you know, I forget the exact line, but HAL and Chandra have this conversation, and HAL says, "Thank you for telling me the truth. You know, I understand now. Thank you for telling me the truth." And suddenly the golem is back on course. So it's like, seems, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but that seems very explicitly in line with that mythology.
Yeah, my rabbi has a book from the, I think it's actually maybe even 14th century. I mean, he doesn't have the original, he has a print of it, but it's the, like, official How to Generate a Golem book, written in, I don't know, it might be written in Hebrew, but I think it might be written in Aramaic. But basically, there's this whole part of it where they have the letters of the Hebrew alphabet in a circle, and you basically generate a geometry by connecting in a particular combination, visualizing one letter to the next across this circle, and basically you make it more and more rapid. And the amount of concentration it would take to actually do what they're saying would need to be done is, like, fucking unbelievable. Because the thing is supposedly birthed from your... they say literally, like, it translates as the middle brain. So this thing comes out of your head. it's kind of crazy. And it's that you're an extension of the creator. It's not like the way that one would expect, I think, if they had certain assumptions about the demonic or whatever, you know, because the thing is still people say it's soulless, you know, but in a sense it has a spark of life. You're giving it a spark of life, you know. But I don't know. I look at Hal and it seems like he's the his eye is suggestive of the source, but it's like a substitute source. It's like it has the appearance of being where we're headed to, or where we want to get to, like the ultimate aim that is liberation. But it's like there's nothing there, you know, other than reflection, other than look back at yourself. You can go deeper and deeper into it, and it's just further and further reflecting you back through the mechanics of it. Because we have a mechanics, but that's not ultimately who we are, you know.
But isn't that basically what you were saying? The idea, if the golem is sort of a projection of your middle brain, it's you yourself sort of in that figure, then it would be a reflective, absolutely, yeah.
Well, totally.
The word that popped out in this discussion is the word malfunction. Mm. And I've never thought of it this way, but Mal for Malkuth is Hal trying to work in that lowest sphero, you know? The alien race, if we're going to say the alien race is what brought the monolith to Earth in the first place, they don't put any message on it. They don't. It's as benign of an artifact to put into an environment that you could possibly put in. But yet it is drenched in the uncanny because it is this straight-lined, smooth, perfect object that sticks out from everything else in the environment. So it is just the essence of the uncanny in that environment. And they realize that that's all you need to instill to create a revolution, or a conscious revolution. But then the humans trying to recreate what that is, which ultimately is Hal, when you put that into the environment of, I don't know, when however you're trying to utilize that sort of reflection of pure uncanny, it's destined to malfunction in the sphere in which it's born. Do you follow that?
Yeah. What I was thinking, since we're on Kubrick, is Full Metal Jacket. Private Pyle, what is your major malfunction?
Yeah.
Private Joker. It's a private joke.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and then it's also Joker, and then you have the Joker as Heath Ledger, and then you have Heath Ledger as the Hanged Man with fucking shit written on his forehead, you know. Like a puppet. It's kind of weird.
Now, if you think about it, when you look at Full Metal Jacket, basically they are trying to turn him into, you know, so they're calling him a pile of shit. It really is like a failed alchemical transformation, right? Mm. A pile of shit that we're trying, you know, the military is trying to refine into this killing machine.
Wow, that's perfect. Yeah, thanks for that. I never made the Holy Mountain Full Metal Jacket connection before. That's great. Huh.
Doesn't he say something like, I'm going to rip off your head and shit down your throat?
Absolutely.
But the idea of removing the head, you know, again, this is sort of, you know, we could take this a number of ways, but either as an ego death or the idea of sort of like whatever your malfunctioning brain is, I'm going to take that off. to be replaced or refined. I don't know if that's a little...
There's a whole thing in Kabbalah of the holy shit. Literally, is how it translates. It's like the necessary thing for the tree to grow. There's a whole notion of the irrigation, which is where we get the fountain. The fountain of youth, as we know it, as far as I can tell from what I've looked at from 16th century Kabbalistic texts, is they basically they have this notion of this fountain that is like it brings endless renewal to the tree, and along with that, there is a whole idea of shit that is absolutely necessary. That we have, it's when we become aware of it, we have a repulsion to this thing. But without this thing, nothing is born. And so there's all this stigma around it, but meanwhile, it's absolutely essential. And so, you know, you could definitely go there with Full Metal Jacket, basically acknowledging that. Also, I was considering that the Klipot are seen as that way, which are the outside forces surrounding the tree, that have in you know, are seen as in the exile of the Shekinah to have taken over the tree, and they're likened to shit, and that's appropriate because they're called a shell or husk. That's the way they translate. Chalice from Latin translates the same way, which I found interesting, was the Klipot chalice correspondence and all the imagery around that. But the idea of a full metal jacket in a sense being like the Klipot, you know. Yeah. And you will be in a world of shit. We are in a world of shit. And like the idea of Malkut also being when Malkut is the Shekinah in exile, basically you're putting the Shekinah into a world of shit, is literally what it's taken as in the Old Testament.
And they are, now you might maybe, Charlie could be something similar to a chalice. That's just one thought. But what I was really getting out of that is the idea of, right, to get into the tree, what do? Is after boot camp, then they enter the jungle. They're literally in, right, Vietnam is always referred to as the jungle, or you're in the shit, but you're in the jungle. Mm-hmm. So you're literally going into the tree, into that.
They have Charlie Brown, by the way. They have Charlie Brown imagery in the room when they're doing the press deal.
Go back to Pyle. Without Pyle in that lineup, without Pyle's absolute inability to follow directions, it's almost as if all those individuals wouldn't realize just how bad the pile of shit is. When they do that opening scene and everyone's getting their head shaved, and they show all these soldiers, they're just getting their head shaved, and it's no big deal, and there's like this coldness and this focus to their eyes. But when they get to Pyle, he's clearly stoned out of his mind, or on acid or something. I mean, he is that... He's somewhere and everywhere, and just in a daze. You know? It's as if...
Thank you, though. When you said, that's right, the movie opens with them shaving the head, which is another holy mountain. The
movie, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Feel like, and you know, Pyle and Gomer Pyle, which they're referencing, is a pile of shit TV show. You ever really considered that to be anything close to high art, you'd be a moron. But yet... Mm-hmm. This whole nation turning on to, I mean, you could watch Gomer Pyle if you were on Pod or if you were a grandma. But, I mean, unless you were force-fed it, it's not something that you would pull off of the human library and sit down to really enjoy.
It came from No Time for Sergeants, right, which was with Andy Griffith. So the Andy Griffith show, you know, they had it was a play. It was like, I think it was on Broadway originally, and then they made a movie out of it. But yeah, it's called No Time for Sergeants. Might be worth watching for the sync web if you want to really consider different angles. I don't know. I forget how everything that happens. But for some reason, I'm equating it in my mind with Dr. Strangelove. But anyways, I'd have to watch it again.
It's weird that there is a soundbite of Gomer Pyle in Pink Floyd's The Wall.
That's right. There fucking is. Right. Yeah, good job. I forgot about that.
Which, you know, when you get this deep into it, you're like, oh, just another happy coincidental fragment put in by Roger Waters, or what the fuck's going on there? What
that is was the sound one of the last like? Things I experimented with, like a month ago. I watched the whole Full Metal Jacket with Pink Floyd's The Wall, and parts of it aligned really well, but not enough so for me to feel confident to put it up with the rest of mine. But it was very enjoyable. Highly recommend it.
Well, you know, in the journey of putting together 2001, The Shining, and The Wall, you know, I experimented with putting, you know, Eyes Wide Shut and 2001 together, Full Metal Jacket and The Shining together. You know, there are sections that definitely align, and you get that beautiful vision. And obviously for me, out of all those experiments, the thing that I've released or I've put up there is the clearest view or the clearest vision of, you know, three things uniting into one. You know, Full Metal Jacket as a film, it's so clearly divided into two distinct parts. So I don't know how to work with that film regarding that. I mean, more than any other movie for Kubrick, I mean, it seems like two movies sandwiched into one.
You know, there's the take that that pile doesn't actually exist, and that basically he's on a certain level, he's the part of themselves that's resisting the programming.
Yeah,
and it's basically just fucking eradicated, and yeah. The whole thing is expressing that they're everything that's like a depth of themselves that they felt like they needed, and that they ultimately end up rejecting. And it's Joker is like basically the last one to release it, and it's during the murder/subliminal gangbang at the end of the assassin, who turns out to be female, you know, and they have this whole equation with killing and sex. They're the same thing, or the government is trying to force them to believe that they're the same thing, and manipulate them in that way, you know. So
in Holy Mountain, there's the like kind of paraplegic midget, and when they're going across, when they're about to go across the river, he says, you still have a monster inside of you. You have to get rid of it.
And throws him off the boat.
Right. Just when the idea of this being that last part that they have, that they're still resisting, that they have to sort of let go of. I wouldn't, you know, any other time of my life, I wouldn't have considered Jodorowsky as some sort of anything but just an artistic genius, but with this in mind, that there is a similarity there. Have you ever seen El Topo?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So what does El Topo mean? It means the mole, right?
Right.
Obviously, it's this idea of, you know, vitriol, you know, going to the center of the earth. So he's digging in, and so he digs the tunnel, but it could also be that alchemical transformation of going to the center and all this sort of stuff. But
also be a spy.
Well, right, exactly. So a mole is also a spy, and at the end of the movie, right, what does he do? But he basically pulls a Columbine, shoots everybody, and then kills himself, and then suddenly he's enlightened. How is that transition sort of happen? And if you were trying to program a Manchurian candidate, and I hesitate to even say this out loud, but I just have to throw it out there. since we're having this strange Full Metal Jacket, like you said, you know, the idea of the sex is death, and that's a very old idea, and certainly, you know, with the petite mort, you know, this idea of the small death. I mean, it's something I think is pretty fundamental in nature, that there's sort of two sides of the same coin. But just as a strange little correlation there, if there is this correlation between being the killing machine that you need to be, El Topo certainly seems to fit into that imagery. Sorry, did I just throw a bummer?
No, it's huge. It's just I've never really, I'm considering, in my mind with the Holy Mountain, that was ultimately funded by John Lennon. That's one of the awesome things about John Lennon is he knew where to put his money, you know, while he was alive. It was like they ran out of money, and it was actually John Lennon who came through and helped them out with that. And I don't know if you guys have seen the video that I put of Marilyn Manson, Hollywood, with the Holy Mountain. I don't know if you got to watch that, but that's there's a song in it that's Lamb of God, the name of it, and it's basically blatantly about John Lennon and the death of John Lennon. He said, "We were looking for the Lamb of God. We were looking for Mark David. If you die when there's no one's, if you die and there's no one watching, if your ratings drop and you're forgotten, if they kill you on the TV, you're a martyr and the Lamb of God." I was like, considering, you know, I've been running around in circles with a whole John Lennon connection to that, and I've also been running around in circles with John Lennon's connection with The Shining, which, I mean, The Shining itself from Stephen King is named after the John Lennon song Instant Karma, where he says, "We all shine on." And, you know, considering that it came out 4 months before John Lennon was killed, and that Wendy's sitting there reading The Fucking Catcher in the Rye in her opening scene, and just like there's levels to that, you know, to go into. But yeah, that's interesting, the Jodorowsky Kubrick connection via John Lennon. I could probably meditate on that for a minute and get back to you.
Well, what does Jack Torrance say right before he breaks through the door?
Here's Johnny.
To get to Wendy. Here's Johnny.
Which was the other target of Mark David Chapman, was Johnny Carson.
Do you guys know George Harrison's All Things Must Pass?
Yeah.
My
Sweet Lord.
Well, I was going to say, it's Johnny's birthday. There's a track called It's Johnny's Birthday. And I know Clapton's playing on it. I don't know if who else is. There's a few. But I think it's Billy Preston and Eric Clapton. I'm going to have to check that out. But, you know, this idea of it's Johnny's birthday. I went somewhere in my head. I think I found something, but I don't know if I can make it clear.
I have the LP in my hand right now. My Sweet Lord, wah wah, isn't it a pity? Hold on, I'll see what I can. There's so many songs. It's Johnny's birthday, side five. Okay. Hold on.
I'm happy that you also have the LP. It's what I'm holding in my hand, yeah.
Oh, yeah? Okay, what is it here? Oh, is it on the special one? You know, that came with this, the Apple Jam or whatever?
Yes, Apple Jam.
Yeah, it's on the Apple Jam. Okay. Or is it? I don't know. I'm seeing.
It's Apple Jam.
Yeah, it's on side five. It's Johnny's birthday. There's no. I mean, it's George Harrison, Mel Evans, Eddie Klein. But yeah, not much more than that. I could play it, but I'm not gonna plug my stuff in. But yeah, this is that's the best record on the set. It's the fucking Apple Jam. I don't think it has lyrics. It's just a jam, right?
Yeah, I think we're looking at this. Like, I actually have the one from 71, so it's. I think the more modern. I have a CD when they remastered it, and that. That has no lyrics either, because they're mostly just our jams. Like, it's Johnny's birthday. I think the only lyric is, it's Johnny's birthday.
Mm-hmm. Weird.
Ignore that. I'll think about it.
Oh, God. Yeah, I watched something last night on George Lucas. Called The People versus George Lucas. Which is funny because there's another movie called... Oh, no, 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 that's the
Sorry,
US.
No, I have to interrupt you. I have to interrupt you. I figured it out.
Okay.
Okay, the jam tracks, okay, there's five jam tracks. And it's Out of the Blue is the first one. Now, does that make you think of anything?
Yeah, Neil Young.
Well, right, but that's what Kurt Cobain cited in his suicide note.
That's fucking right.
Yeah. So Out of the Blue, Into the Black, that's the song that Cobain quoted in his suicide note. Then it's Johnny's Birthday, which if it's coming from Harrison, we have to assume it's John Lennon he's talking about.
Uh-huh.
Then the next song is Plug Me In, which I actually used as the name of a chapter in my book, which is referring to a artificial intelligence. It's a chapter called Plug Me In. It's where they turn on this massive artificial intelligence. So, at least in my mind, it's connected to a HAL, all this, you know, this sort of topic that we've been discussing with the AI. Next song, I Remember Jeep, which we could take to Vietnam. And then the last one is Thanks for the Pepperoni, which goes to your gangbang.
Yeah, and pizza.
Right.
It all ends in a gangbang, doesn't it?
That's right.
So
thanks for the pepperoni.
You know the William S. Burroughs, Kurt Cobain connection?
Yeah.
They were hanging out and recorded The Junkie together.
The priest, they called him. What is it?
And he was with him very close to the end of his life. And I've always kind of wondered about that, because right around that same time, there's this fucked up video of William S. Burroughs going around his house and showing all his fucking guns and large fucking knives and all this shit. And he's just like basically calling himself the exterminator, like he always called himself, but keeps on giving this fucking weird ass air that he's like, you know, out to kill all the anti-homosexuals, you know. And it's just super kind of like, I've read a lot of Burroughs. I'm actually, to a degree, a Burroughs fan. I wouldn't want to be a young Puerto Rican boy around him. But I enjoy a lot of his works, particularly The Western Lands, which has been huge in my analysis of Sync. But at the same time, I don't know. I thought that was really curious. I'm like, wow, he's like hanging out with WB, and he's doing lots of heroin with him, and this guy like looks pretty fucking like he's serious about some shit. And but the way that the film, the Cronenberg Naked Lunch, ends, like with his wife who he had shot in the head and got away with, you know, basically like because of his state, I guess, you know, it's like with the old William Teller routine, and he shoots her in the head because to prove that he's a writer, you know. He's like, prove that you're a writer, and he pulls out a pen, and he's like, well, I have a writing device, and he's like, that's not enough, and then he's like, oh, it's time for a William Teller routine, and shoots his wife in the head again. It's like, I don't know, it's weird.
It's what happens to Private Pyle.
Right, and he's Burroughs, like a mole Burroughs.
Oh, yes.
He's also a huge Thelemite, William F. Burroughs was.
Yeah.
And so that's another side of it. So, I mean, there's a really great recording of him talking about dreams where he brings in Crowley and gives an explanation for things. And
really? So,
yeah. I'll send it your way. I'll find it. Yeah, it's a good one.
Now, I was just talking to Jason Brera recently where... about David Bowie utilizing the cut-up technique in his songs.
Mm-hmm.
And we went a number of directions in that, but I'd have to pull up the notes, because this actually was got a really intense, interesting conversation, but the idea that you have this Bowie connection, who, of course, you have your David Bowman, you know, your David Bowie, your man from outer space. I'm sorry, that's a little abstract, but I have to pull...
Not at all. I've been tripping on it, yeah. The Man Who Fell to Earth, actually, is the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's exactly right there.
Yeah. No, it's huge. And then it's the DB 42 and Beyond the Infinite, you know, and fucking Buzz Lightyear to Infinity and Beyond, played by opposite Tom Hanks, who's the fucking cowboy or whatever. And Andy's cowboy. Where did Andy come in? There was this whole tripping out on Andy Kaufman being Man on the Moon, Andy in Toy Story,
Hanks
Infinity
was...
and Beyond, Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, Apollo 13.
Exactly.
Little Danny with the fucking Apollo sweater, Tom Hanks in Apollo 13, Tom Hanks is the cowboy, There's a Snake in My Boot, Ophiuchus. Like, I went on this whole fucking thing around that at one point.
the guy who plays Buzz Lightyear, Tim Allen. Yeah. He was also in a movie, some weird, like, starship movie Sigourney Weaver, was it? Or
yeah, Amy loves it. What is that called?
Weren't they, like, on a TV show, and they really get abducted by aliens, and they're, it's like a Ender's Game thing. They think they're doing a TV show, but it's real, or...
Yeah, and they basically make fun of Lost in Space and Star Trek, but yeah, I'm forgetting what it's called, but yeah.
Oh, but you know, Bill, the idea that they think they're on a TV show, but it's real, goes to that idea of 2001, the monolith being the movie screen.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, there really is this sort of strange 2001 connection with To Infinity and Beyond, and he realizes he's in the, that, you know, he thinks he's in the movie, but it's real. It's sort of that same exiting of the...
I had, like, a sync-gasm when I fucking watched the new Willy Wonka, and they have the whole 2001 segment, and he reaches into the screen and pulls out the monolith, which is a candy bar. He turns the monolith into a Wonka bar and eats it.
Jesus.
And he's like, look, you can interact with it. And that's it. They just nailed it completely.
Wow.
You know, because he's like, it's an interactive thing, which is what Kubrick was pointing at, that this isn't something, we're not spectators here. It might appear on the surface that we're going to a film and we're, but the, you know, the description's not the described, but the observer is the observed. And it's a total paradox, you know, and it's weird how we take on this role of that we're going to just watch something, and meanwhile we're creating it at the same time with our relationship to the imagery and the Lampoon characters and everything, you know.